Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. There's a better world to come in. Tell you why. There's a better world to come in. Tell you why. We will feed them on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world to come in. Tell you why. There's a better world to come in. Don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world to come in. Don't you see? Good evening and welcome. I'm Rick Spezak, News Director of Progressive News Network. I'm your host, and I want to welcome you to another adventure in Progressive News, featuring the finest in progressive voices from across the state of Florida. I'm going to be joined in just a minute by my exciting co-host and leader of Progressive Push, Luis Cuevas, who will be with me in just a moment. First, I've got a couple of stories I want to share with you. I'm sure you heard all about the 500,000 people that gathered yesterday in Japan to protest the restart of nuclear power. Oops, you didn't hear it? Oh, what do you do, pay attention to mainstream media or something? Yes, if you want to know the news about Japan, you have to dig, ladies and gentlemen. And, of course, if you dig over there, your radioactive shovels will be very dangerous. Couple other stories on the Fukushima front. It seems that our government is, by and large, no longer monitoring anything because, you know, everything is just okay. Southern California is still getting hit by Fukushima radiation at alarming high levels that will inevitably increase as the main bulk of polluted Pacific water reaches North America over the next 2 years. Luckily, the area south of where the jet stream has brought hot rains from across the Pacific and Fukushima, more than 5,000 miles away, upwind and up current from the Pacific coast. Those rains have brought extraordinary amounts of radiation to places like St. Louis, with multiple rain events detected and filmed showing increasingly hot rains. Unluckily, North America is directly downwind of Japan, where the government is having 560,000 tons of irradiated rubble incinerated with the ash dumped in Tokyo Bay. Of course, because then it'll just disappear. Yepper. The 70-mile-wide current from Japan currently joins the North Pacific Current, moving eastward until it splits and flows southward along the California Current, which flows along the coast of Ventura County and beyond. The American government has done nothing to monitor the Pacific Ocean for over half a year, even though a Texas-sized Sea of Japan earthquake debris front is already washing up on outlying Alaskan islands and is suspected to have already hit the West Coast, including California. In terms of radiation, the EPA is in charge of Radiation Network for Airborne Radiation. It's called RadNet. EPA Administrator Jared Blumenfeld told VC Reporter on February 9th during a news conference about a new ship sewage regulations, and we have a very significant comprehensive array of RadNet monitors along, not actually along the coast, but on land. We don't have jurisdiction for looking at marine radiation. Perhaps NOAA might be able to answer that question. But we don't have the data to monitor it, he said. NOAA, National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, suspended testing along the Pacific for Fukushima radiation last summer, because, of course, it's all over now, after concluding that there just wasn't any radiation at all to be detected. Hey, isn't that nice? A BC report learned that the California Department of Public Health halted monitoring of Fukushima fallout when its radiological health branch issued its last report October 10, 2011. That report showed an alarming rise in cesium-137 in Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo dairy farm milk beginning June 14, 2011, when it tested 2.9 picocuries per liter and steadily rising before subsequent tests until it was 5.91 picocuries. The hot milk was twice the allowable amount of radionucleotide in drinking water, according to the EPA's 3.0 picocurie limit. Okay, on another front, ladies and gentlemen, Sybil Edmonds, who you may know as the most classified woman, had some comments on a recent interview show on Fire Dog Lake. I'm just going to bring you a couple of these quotes. I think they're interesting and certainly bear your attention. She says, among other things, these are all quotes of hers. Look, this is how I sum up our democracy elections. There is one and only one establishment. They pick two of their favorite puppets. One's tagged D, the other's tagged R. They present these two picks, and then they say, okay, now you get to choose between the two. We'll call it democracy. And this goes on to the macro issues, diseases we face, etc. By the way, you can help Ms. Edmonds' cause by calling on Congress to push for the declassification and release of the 2004 Department of Justice Inspector General's investigation into charges made by Ms. Evans. You may remember she was an FBI translator who, when she told them about people double-teaming the system, about spies in the FBI translator department, she was told she's not allowed to speak. she said she was the first victim of the SSP by the Bush administration's Secrets Act, and she went to attorneys. They had no idea what the SSP referred to. No one had heard of it, and when she Googled it, she got six results, three of them repeats. Once my attorneys researched and found out about the SSP, they thought, no way in hell any federal judge would let the executives get away with this. It's like the nuclear executive privilege. Well, they were wrong. Federal judges let the government get away with it. They didn't even question it. There was no grilling whatsoever. The government didn't even have to justify it. Now, they said the justification will damage state secrets, and that was it, the State Secrets Act. Saddest part, media giving the SSP invocation twice in my case, no real coverage. I stood before the court appeals and told the reporter, this is a test case, that they're getting away with it. You'll be seeing the SSP invoked right and left. She also said, I didn't have high expectations for the Obama administration. However, the level of secrecy and retaliation against whistleblowers far exceeded my expectations. For me and for over 100 whistleblowers I represent, the administration has been worse by far, very alarming. She says, also, the Obama presidency was no cause to celebrate. Certainly, he looked and talked better than his opponent, but that was where the difference ended. She had dealt with Obama's Senate office and saw as a national security whistleblower and had tried to work with his office and some others, all to no avail. He was as anti-whistleblower and anti-transparency and anti-accountability as they come, along with many of his colleagues there, including Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton. By the way, there's a H.R. 668 that you should be aware of. It's about hardening the electrical grid against pulse weapons. It's being stalled. You should know about that. And, of course, you should know that we're beefing up our resources in the Gulf because, of course, the war boys, you know, need to just, you know, have another war. And you may also know there's threats to union organizers down in Colombia. The unions have asked those of us who are aware of union issues to support the union people down in Colombia. Of course, they are not faring well. They're being assassinated left and right. And you may also know that Bradley Manning had a slight victory. The government's been told they need to come up with some of the documents they've been sitting on. You probably know that Julian Assange is still cooling his heels in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. And Jimmy Carter has accused the U.S. of widespread abuses of human rights. Former presidents accusing the current president of sanctioning widespread abuse of human rights by authorizing drone strikes to kill suspected terrorists. Jimmy Carter, America's 39th president, denounced the Obama administration for clearly violating 10 of the 30 articles of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, writing in the New York Times op-ed on Monday that the United States is abandoning its role as a global champion of human rights. And as you know, this is the Human Rights Show. We have Alan Hendricks from the organizer for Equality Florida in Palm Beach. We've got Tony Armstrong, a founder of BLAST. We've got Summer Gentry, a professor at the Navy War College and also a anti-TSA activist. We've got Meredith Ackman, vice president of the State National Organization of Women and president of the Palm Beach Now. We're also going to have Jay Alexander working on the Civilian Conservation Corps' re-up. And then to wrap it up, we'll have Keith McHenry, one of the founders of Food Not Bombs. Without any further ado, let me welcome Luis Cuevas.
Hey there. How you doing?
Very good, sir. We are honored, as always, to have you. How are you tonight?
I'm great. It's my pleasure always to be on your show.
Well, sir, we have such a full plate of issues. My goodness. Let me ask you first to weigh in on the interesting Supreme Court ruling.
Yes, that was obviously a bigger surprise for the Republicans than it was for the Democrats. I think that he's been caught in a number of images throughout the country, how they were ready to celebrate the demise of health care, and then CNN, Fox, actually went out, you know, it was like a Freudian slip.
Another Dewey Truman moment, huh?
Yeah, you know, they came out and they said, oh, wait a minute. There is this congresswoman who actually was waiting outside of the court, and she was celebrating big time. She was caught on camera, and and they told her, no, the court decided the other way. Of course, we have to be aware of that. What the court decided and what the healthcare system is, it is far, far away from what many people want, and that is universal healthcare for all.
Can I share a little bit of information with you right now?
Please,
you bring up a very important point, and I'm with you 100%. One of the things I wanted to share with you is the health insurance company CEO's compensation for 2011. David Cordani of Cigna got $19 million, which is only $52,000 a day. Stephen Hemsley of United Health only earned $13.3 million last year. That's only a paltry $36,000, $438 per day. Angela Braly of WellPoint only earned a pittance of $13.2 million. Dropped way down to $36,000 a day. Alan Wise of Coventry, $12.9 million, the Piker. Mark Bettolini of Aetna only earned $10.5 million, a paltry $28,000 a day. And Michael McAllister of Humana earned a measly little $7.3 million. You know, it's a wonder how these boys can even stretch their budget, you know?
Yeah, don't worry about it because they have their taxable deductions. And, you know, they have all these, deferments, all these business expenses that they can deduct, which the average worker cannot take care of. I mean, there's no way that you can deduct most of any one of your expenses if you are a working human being. But if you're a business person, everything, including your health care insurance, is deductible. So you can maximize your profits.
Yep, so we know that the welfare queens in the insurance industry have got themselves covered. We'll get more to that in a minute. Let me go ahead and bring on our first guest.
Excellent.
I think we have Alan Hendricks here. Thanks so much, Louise. I'm so glad you could join us. Alan, welcome.
Hi, Rick. How are you?
Very good, sir. Do you know Louis Cuevas?
I do.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. That's good. You're among friends, Alan. So tell us, Alan, welcome to the Human Rights Show. Why don't you share with us some of where you see things are today?
It's all about elections right now, Rick. here we go. Our primary season is upon us, and the big election, as it were, in November is very, very close, and it's going to be a close race, I think, here in Florida. So we're in election and campaign mode, which means we're sending out our questionnaires, we're doing our voter guides, and locally working on campaigns for progressives all across the state. That's where we're at right now. Because if we don't, we'll pay the consequences of that. And the reason Florida is not further along is because who we have up in Tallahassee. So that is where Equality Florida is at right now. That's what we're rocking and rolling on.
Well, let me ask you this. We have seen some victories. Why don't you tell us a little bit, kind of go over ground. We have seen some victories on human rights issues this past year. Why don't you maybe tick some of those off, make people feel a little good for a moment?
Wow, yeah, we really have. The one that pops to mind immediately was Orlando, and shortly thereafter, Orange County passed a human rights ordinance, which is big news for me because it's the I-4 corridor. You know, down here in South Florida, we have our struggles, but we're a bit more progressive. And that I-4 corridor is always kind of a real battleground for the state. So it was awesome to see that happen in that area. Right now, we're close to getting a human rights ordinance in Jacksonville, which is, again, big news since Jacksonville is more conservative, if you will. So we've had a lot of victories here in Florida, which is awesome. We have a lot of out candidates running that have really good chance of winning state seats this year. And, of course, you know, our president finally evolved on marriage equality, which is a big deal, you know. That is, along with our polling nationally on marriage equality, continues to move. You know, it's past 50%. It's on its way to 60% approval of same gender people having the same marriage rights as their siblings and their peers. So it's been good. It's been very good. All that being said, we still have a lot of work to do.
Are there any state races that you're focused on? I know Luis is going to be very aware of what's going on that progresses in this state.
Yes.
Luis, why don't you two share some thoughts on that direction?
Yeah, one of the most important things is that we've been trying to focus on is to get folks to realize that if you got an issue, if you got a program that you know is right, is the right thing to do, you need to be challenging the system. And you do that in more than one way. One of them is, and that's our direction because we are a candidate, a federal PAC, and that means that we deal with candidates, not with issues. The system separates them both. But one thing that we want to do is get people to run for office, and I think that is where we have, you know, a tremendous revolution in our political system right now, because more than ever before, we're having people come over and say, I want to run, I've had enough, this is it, and they're showing up in numbers. And it means that, you know, they're coming in and saying, I want to run for mayor, I want to make a difference. You see, we got in Gainesville, we got Craig Lowe, who said unabashedly, I am gay, I am running for mayor, and he won. You see, and that is what needs to be done. That is the most amazing thing that we're seeing. That's what changes things. That's what changes mentalities. That is what brings in progress.
Alan, are there some races that you want to draw our audience's attention to in Florida?
I have a prediction. I predict we will have two state representatives who are openly LGBT this election. How do you like that prediction?
That sounds pretty good.
Well, you know, you have to have a seat at the table, and it makes a big difference. When you're at that table, people are more inclined to understand your issues and vote the correct way. when you're at the table, and I believe that Joe Saunders in East Orlando is going to win.
Yes.
He's got to get through his primary, and after that, I think it's, you know, he's got a great ground game. He's got great fundraising. He's a great candidate, and it's just prime. I think he's going to win. We also have Ian, I can't remember his last name, in Monroe County down in the Keys, the north part of the Keys. And he's running a strong race. And I can't think. We've got a few. We just went over our pack endorsements the other day. And, you know, everything from you know, school board to, you know, state reps, we've got some good progressives. You know, I'm here in Palm Beach County. Here in Palm Beach County, we're blessed with a demographic that's a little more blue than the rest of the state. But all of those voices matter. But you know, openly LGBT people, we haven't had anyone at the state level thus far, and I think this is our year to at least have two people, maybe three.
Alan,
three.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, Alan. Could you send me? You know, we're on the air right now, but later on, if you can send me a number of candidates that you think are worthwhile supporting, really, and Progressive Push can take a look at them, and we can invite them to apply for endorsement for this election. Just write me a note to Luis, L-U-I-S, at progressivepush.org.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, that brings up another, and I'll make this quick, here locally, and I hope across the state, I believe across the state, this is what I'm hoping to do here in Palm Beach County and other places, is to work with, to work well with our Latino brothers and sisters.
Mm-hmm.
And do a better job of you know, working together on that, because we're Florida is going to be tight. I mean, it's a little closer than I'd like for it to be, which also is a great opportunity for, you know, these different kind of demographics to come together and find out they really have some political power, especially if they work together.
Absolutely, solidarity is what it's about.
Yep.
All right.
Alan, let me ask you, people who want to support and work with Equality of Florida, what's the best way for them to get in touch with you?
EQFL.org.
EQFL.org. That's great.
That's
well, thanks so much for joining us, buddy. Any final thoughts you want to leave with the audience?
Always a pleasure. Look forward to Rock the Vote. Which is a voter registration and concert and just all-around good party to be coming to Palm Beach County in the mid part of September.
Well, super. Thanks so much for letting us know.
Sure. I'll send it along as soon as I get more details.
Okay. Thanks a lot. We'll help you promote it.
Awesome.
All right, Rick. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks again, Alan.
All right, Rick. Have a good one.
You too, buddy. Bye-bye.
Thanks,
Matt. Alan Hendricks of Equality of Florida, a wonderful, progressive human rights activist right here on the East Coast. What a guy. Thanks so much, Alan. Luis, let's continue. You know, there's I hear all this punditry reporting on the horse race and who won and who lost. I mean, I didn't hear anybody at all talk about, you know, what kind of health care is going to be available to people at what kind of cost. It was almost like health care was not even an issue. It was all about
right.
the politics.
Yes, and that's the way they want it. Essentially, they don't want to take a look at the ground rules, the facts, what actually is going to affect people. And what I am getting from a lot of people and saying, all right, Sure, this was a decision by the court, and it says that you can go this way, but what we want is universal health care. I mean, there's lots and lots of people out there who are coming out now and saying it louder and louder. What we need is health care for all. What we need is Medicare for all. Is any one of these terms, because the media has a way of manipulating them, but people are tired of this. And of course, we've got some folks who are actually, it was incredible how CNN and Fox came out in a Freudian slip, and we talked about that earlier, and said, boom, oh yeah, they lost. But hey, wait a minute. It says that essentially people are entitled because of the fact that they are taxpayers to have some degree of protection. And
Hold that thought, because yeah. I want to go ahead and bring Tony Armstrong
into
the night, okay?
All right, excellent.
Welcome, Tony.
Hey, Rick, how's it going?
Very good. I want to welcome you on this, our Human Rights Night, and thank you for joining us. Tony, the first thing I want to ask you is, I always ask all my guests the first time they're on to give us some sense of what was it. You know, I mean, life is challenging enough, you know, making a living, trying to have a life, you know, finding friends and lovers and all that stuff. But it takes a special kind of person to say, you know, all that's true, but I need to go the extra mile. I need to contribute. I need to do something to make this a better world. What was it for you, dear? Can I ask you to talk a little bit about yourself and tell us what moved you to try to work to make this a better world?
Sure. Well, I grew up with a mother who was very activist. From the time I was a little preschool kid, she was telling me little kid stories about how, oh, it's just so wrong when people treat people of other races the wrong way. And let me tell you a story about what these terrible people did, and wasn't that terrible. So, you know, I very much grew up with that, and came out early in high school, became an activist my first year of college right after Stonewall, and basically just hit the ground running. You know, the world, no, they always say people, you know, the world nobody ever said it would be fair. And I feel like, well, nobody ever said it has to be unfair either. You know, we make the difference.
Well, that's great. Why don't you tell us a little bit about BLAST?
Okay, BLAST is, BLAST stands for Bi, Lesbian, and Straight Together, Women of the Palm Beaches, and it's a group that has over 1,000 members. Our mission statement is to do things by, for, and about women in Palm Beach County. So we have all sorts of activities. It's not really an organization. It's a community of women, bi, lesbian, and straight together, women who just want to do things with women. Some of it's very political. Some of it's very social. Some of it, we have our own softball team, et cetera.
Well, that's great. That's great.
Yeah, anybody who's interested in that actually should go to meetup.com/blast, WPB. meetup.com/blast, WPB.
Well, that's great. So tell me, you know, this is the Human Rights Show. What is your perspective right now on where we stand? We're making some progress. We've got challenges. What is your perspective? What are you working on right now?
Well, first of all, I think human history in every country in every time is full of human rights abuses, full of people who are going to abuse any power that they can get. So, you know, I see it as a long haul kind of a thing. I have another suggestion for listeners to follow the election, to become happy and go ahead and write in pen the Obama reelection night party that they're going to plan. It's electoral-vote.com, electoral-vote.com, and the dash is like, you know, punctuation. What that site does every single day is analyze every poll from everywhere, and every single day it changes the map so that you can see, you know, where everybody is from solid red to solid blue and everywhere in between. Huffington Post has a map that a lot of people look at, but it isn't updated as often, and they don't use as many polls. And let me say, if the election was held today, Obama has well over 320 electoral votes, and he needs 270. So I'm feeling real good about this November. I'm not 100% satisfied by any means with this administration's record on human rights, but I'm much happier than I was for the previous 8 years.
Good yeah. point. Good point.
You know, I think one of the things that of course, you know, I think a lot of people are watching is DOMA, which is the Defense of Marriage Act, federal legislation that basically defines marriage as between one man and one woman. A lot of people are confused about that. You know, states have their own DOMA. We, of course, have the horrible Amendment 2 here in Florida. Prop 8 out in California is probably the most famous. And I'm not sure everyone's aware, there's two lawsuits working their way up to the Supreme Court. One is the Prop 8, California. The other one is the state of Massachusetts is suing the federal government, saying you can't force us to discriminate against our own citizens. So my opinion, I do not want this 5-4 Supreme Court hearing the DOMA case. I think that we are going to get our own Plessy v. Ferguson. And that, of course, took 50 years to overturn.
So, am I safe to assume that you don't think that Judge Roberts has suddenly seen the light and is going to change his conservative ways?
He did surprise us this week, now, didn't he?
Yeah,
sure did.
I think that you know Kennedy is the one who is they're looking at to be the possible swing vote on any DOMA case. That one's going to go either way. But I don't feel confident at all that the Supreme Court is going to do the right thing. And if, in fact, they do hear a DOMA case and they support the federal DOMA, well, in the Plessy v. Ferguson case, you know, late 1890s, they decided to try nonviolent civil disobedience, and that whole case hinged on the whites-only transportation cars of trains. And they really thought if they could get to the Supreme Court that they could overturn that and get, you know, national protection. And what ended up happening, horrible, in fact, one of the worst ever Supreme Court decisions, Plessy v. Ferguson established separate but equal. And so things got far, far worse immediately. And I'm really afraid that if this Supreme Court hears the DOMA cases and rules that, yes, the federal government can, in fact, make this, you know, not even equal, separate and unequal, then what happens to the states that already have, you know, marriage equality? This Supreme Court just overruled the Montana Supreme Court about campaign contributions.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's worrisome.
I've neglected to introduce you to Luis Cuevas. Do you know Luis, Tony?
Hi.
Hello. Good. One of the things I was thinking right now was that it's essentially the Plessy v. Ferguson decision came a few years after the Dred Scott decision.
Mm-hmm.
The Dred Scott decision actually was a trial test. I mean, it was the abolitionists wanted to test the law. And the Supreme Court at that time was pretty much like ours today, in cahoots with the powers that be. And at that time, what they decided, of course, was on the side of the slavers. What most people don't know was that poor Dred Scott and his wife went back into slavery because that was the decision. And this is what, you know, as you were telling us, much of what we are seeing right now, that this court can take any measure it wants. And we have individuals in there like Scalia, Alito, Thomas, and
mm-hmm.
Roberts, that they are hell-bent on an ideology. You know, people have to be aware that yeah, you've got to be on a 24-hour watch. And we want, I mean, you know, progressives somehow in the last few years have been on this knee-jerk reaction to whatever is going on. But no, we need a long-term watch, keeping an eye on what these people are doing, keeping records, keeping track of them, and then having a very well-planned reaction to that, which is not sudden and, oh, wow, what do we do now, which is what we've been doing.
Well, and of course, this is crucial to make sure that we elect a president that's going to appoint moderates to the Supreme Court.
Exactly. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and that's coming up because we have a number of these people who in the next few years will be retiring. I don't think people like Thomas are smart enough to know when they will retire.
Why should they? They don't even have to hear the cases. They know what they're going to decide already.
Exactly.
Why retire?
Saves a lot of time looking for facts, you know.
You're very right. And so go ahead.
I was going to say, again, with the electoral-vote.com website, I'm very heartened by the fact that Florida is holding at leaning toward blue, and it has been for weeks and weeks. I'm very heartened by the fact that Ohio was finally solid blue. At this point, I'm feeling good about Obama being the one who's going to make any further appointments in the next 4 years. The people that don't vote, for whatever reason they don't, this is a piece I think that they're really, really missing, is that, you know, we have to live now with whatever Roberts does for the next 40 years.
Exactly. And, you know, following what you're saying, I think it is, for all of us who are leading progressive groups to actually begin to put the pressure on so that we don't get any more of these conservatives, Republican-oriented mentalities going in there and getting into the Supreme Court.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Tony. I really appreciate it. Do you want to give that organization contact information one more time before you go?
I do. Any women, females, including trans women, who are interested in doing things by, for, and about women in Palm Beach County, meetup.com/blastwpb. Thanks, Rick. Nice to meet you, Louis.
You're very welcome.
Great.
Bye.
Thanks again, Tony. Talk to you again soon. Bye-bye. Ladies and gentlemen, we've got our next guest. We've got Professor Summer Gentry. Welcome, Professor.
Hello, Rick.
How you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. I'm glad to be talking with you.
Well, it's our pleasure to have you. You bring a very important portion to our human rights show. I know I'm going to let you characterize exactly your stance on the TSA. I kind of use shorthand to say you're an anti-TSA activist, but I know it should be more nuanced than that. Why don't you go ahead and tell us about your organization?
Sure. Well, I would say that does characterize my position. I am an anti-TSA activist. I really think that everything the TSA does makes us less safe. That, you know, they like to hide behind, oh, it's okay if we hurt people, it's okay if we spill human remains on the floor, it's okay if we re-traumatize rape survivors, that doesn't matter because we're keeping you safe. But the TSA is not making us any safer. In fact, a lot of the things that they're doing are directly making us more in danger. You know, one example would be we used to be able to lock our bags, and now we have to leave them open and vulnerable to theft, but also tampering. And, you know, another example is that the TSA screeners have been caught smuggling drugs. And if they're taking bribes to put items into suitcases so that they don't know what they are, they might be drugs, they might be the next dangerous item that gets onto an airplane. But I really think that the TSA program is not making us safer, and it's really harming a lot of people. It needs to stop.
I had the most curious experience about 2 months after 9/11. I do software consulting, and one of the firms that I consult with had an appointment with the administration of Miami International Airport. And I did simulation and modeling for them, so I was going to be part of the presentation. And instead of going to the front gate or to the terminal, if you will, administration building is quite far away from the terminal per se. So you enter off a gate that literally drives you right onto the tarmac of the runways. So we pull up. Now, the gentleman I'm with, the leader of this presentation, happened to be a gentleman of Middle Eastern extraction. And so we pull up to the gate. Again, this is just a couple of months after 9/11. And when the guard stops us, we're expecting to, we both have our wallets out. We're ready to give them, you know, all our picture ID. The guard goes, "Oh, no, your business card's fine. Just let me see your business card." And waved us on in. And then,
well, you know, it's a perfect example of the weakest link is the strength of the chain. And by far, there are much weaker defenses of our airports than the passengers boarding the planes. And yet every week, every month, every year, the experience of being a passenger becomes more like entering a prison camp. I mean, we're getting shaken down. I really think that no one deserves to be searched unless the government has probable cause that we did something wrong. You know, all I did is buy an airline ticket. That doesn't really mean that I should have to pose naked for a stranger in the back room or, you know, have a stranger's hand up between my legs down my pants. This is just completely unreasonable.
I never heard the probable cause was removed from our constitutional protections. Why don't you tell us a bit about your experience?
Well, I had a very upsetting experience a few years ago. I was boarding a plane at BWI, and I had a skirt on. I've never done that since this day. I was flagged for a metal detector search, and this was in the days when they were using the handheld wands, where they would, you know, wave the wand near you to figure out what was metal. I hadn't alarmed the detector, but I was flagged anyway, I think because I was wearing a skirt. So this woman took her metal detector and pushed it up between my legs so far that she penetrated me with it. I mean, she pushed my underwear inside my body.
Oh, my God.
It was such a horrible violation. I was sick, and I complained. I complained immediately at the checkpoint in writing. And then when I followed this up with my senator, he wrote back and finally got the TSA to actually answer my complaint. And they wrote me a letter saying, "Well, you know, we're sorry we violated your genital area, but the screener followed all the established procedures correctly." And they said, "It's very difficult for the TSA to search women without contacting them," meaning it's really tough for us not to accidentally rape you, so you'll just have to get used to it. You know, this is how our procedures work. I mean, it was so horrifying to think that the TSA accepts that women deserve to have things inserted inside their bodies who haven't, you know, been suspected of a crime. It's just, it's unreasonable. It's absurd. So, since that day, I've been fighting against the TSA, and then the day that they started these really invasive pat downs was the day I went into full attack mode.
Let me introduce co-host. This is Luis Cuevas, leader of Progressive Push. Go ahead, Luis.
Yeah, I was going to say that. I mean, I know exactly what you're saying. I was coming back from San Juan, Puerto Rico, bringing my mom to live with us because she had dementia. And it was one of those amazing things is that I only have tickets one way. Everything is clear. We got through initial security. We're going to get to the board the airplane, and then TSA says, "Oh no, you only have one way ticket." So they actually put my mom, who is on a wheelchair, to all these intrusive, invasive checkups, and she was shocked, and so was I. And the whole thing was that they don't care what your rights are. They don't care what the situation is. It's a job that they have to do, and that brings us way back into 65 years ago, when people said, you know, it's our job. We just don't think about it. Yes, exactly.
So, Professor Gentry, could you tell us, are there any serious legal cases going on? Is there any consideration being given to reining in this absolute abuse of constitutional authority?
You know, the news on that is really mixed. The TSA has been very effective at rejecting lawsuits brought by many citizens on the grounds that they are somehow not subject to any jurisdiction of any court because they're using secret orders to do what they do, and they can't reveal what their methods are, so we can't examine whether their methods are reasonable or not. But there was a case, the Electronic Privacy Information Center won a case, actually, and the court declared in July 2011 that, this was the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, that the TSA acted illegally when it instituted the body scanner program, when it put body scanners as primary screening, and that the TSA was required by existing law under the Privacy Act to conduct a public notice and comment period to hear from the public about what they thought about these scanners before they became primary screening methods. And so far, the TSA has just thumbed its nose at the court. We have no privacy, we have no public notice and comment period. It's just, the TSA is just blatantly ignoring a legal court order. I can't explain it. Congress needs to just cut off the money. You know, we need to defund the TSA today. And the Congress has been becoming a lot more vocal in recent months. They've really brought John Pistol and his gang of molesters down there for some serious talkings to. But then they still get the money to go on putting their hands down little kids' pants.
You know, that there is no serious assessment of threat certainly being applied, and it's both for this and for that ridiculous no-fly list. I was traveling to Washington and was talking to a judge, a Florida Circuit judge, and she said that about a year earlier, the Florida Supreme Court Chief Justice was turned away from a flight saying that his name was on the no-fly list and was forced to drive to his destination. And of course, we all know that there's no appeal, and it's a secret list, and how things get on the list or off the list is completely unavailable to the public. Clearly,
what
there
happened
is
to due process?
Rick, do you remember
and, you know, and think about the contradiction involved in even having a no-fly list. These are people who are so incredibly dangerous, they can't be allowed to get on an airplane. But we have so little evidence that they've ever done anything wrong that we can't bring them in for questioning.
Sure.
You know, or arrest them. We have nothing. We have no evidence on these people. If we did, we'd arrest them.
Well,
Go ahead, Louis.
You know that we are in trouble when a few years ago, Ted Kennedy was placed on that list of terrorists. It was amazing how when he went to board an airplane, they said, no, you can't because you are in this list. And if that happened to Ted Kennedy, imagine what happens to the average person.
You know, and in fact, it's more significant than just airplane travel, because I'm sure you're aware that TSA has been having its presence felt on buses.
Oh, yeah.
And on trains as well. So,
yeah.
You know, you wonder, is it going to be pass cards? Are we going to be only allowed to leave our hometown for a listed reason? It's very, very curious.
Absolutely, but it's important to realize the limits of what the TSA can and can't do. You can refuse searches anywhere except at an airport checkpoint. That's the only special case that the law allows them to hold you and forcibly search you at a checkpoint in an airport. In a bus station, in a train station, walking down the street, if somebody says they're going to search you, we need to all stand up and say, no, forget it, I don't consent. If it means I don't get to get on my train, fine, but I will not let you search me. I will not let you do this to me. I can't understand why no one.
I'm sorry. One of the things that I found out the other day was that essentially we know that is how it should be. But there was, generally speaking, these big bosses. horses, the Greyhound, so on and so forth, that they carry 40-something passengers. There was a sort of an agreement that they were not to be stopped and be searched and their passengers subjected to it, to that type of thing, and particularly when it comes to immigration. And now we know that it's not true, that actually they are, ICE agents are stopping buses and going in, searching and questioning passengers without any care whatsoever.
Professor Gentry, let me ask you another question. Has there been any response in a positive way from anyone in Congress? I mean, is there anyone who says, yeah, gee, this is too bad? I mean, we do have a few, you know, progressive people in Congress. I can't believe that no one has heard this and said this has gone too far.
I mean, do I have to say Rand Paul is the person who refused to allow the TSA to have its way with him? But there have been a few attempts to rein them in. There was a bill from Marsha Blackburn to stop the screeners from wearing police-like uniforms, and I think that she introduced that bill on the day that a TSA screener was arrested for raping a woman in the street after he lured her into the bushes by flashing his TSA badge. You know, really, these people who are working for the TSA are, a lot of them are criminals, and I don't think that they them checking me out is quite an ironic situation. But I think, TSA is being used as the threat of terrorism is being used as a red herring to look for drugs. They're looking for immigration violations. There just aren't, you know, boogeymen, big terrorist boogeymen hiding behind every tree. I'm not sure how long it's going to take Americans to wake up and see that we're not really at risk of terrorism. You're actually more likely to be killed by a home appliance than a terrorist.
Professor Gentry, let me ask you one last question. If people want to help support the anti-TSA campaign or support a call for reasonable security, how can they get in touch with the organization?
Absolutely. Well, I blog for the TSA News blog, so that's TSANewsBlog.com. And I also work with Freedom to Travel. Freedom to Travel USA was founded by Sharon Cisna and some of her friends after Sharon Cisna was the state senator in Alaska who had to take a 4-day ferry ride home after she refused to let the TSA molest her in Seattle.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. I hope you'll come back again, okay?
Okay, thanks a lot for having me. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Ms. Meredith Ochman, Vice President of Now Florida and also President of Now Palm Beach. Welcome, Meredith.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me back.
It's good to have you. How are you tonight?
I'm wonderful. It's been a good show so far. You've had some of my favorites on the show.
So tell us, this is the Human Rights Show. What do you see? What are you working on right now? What do we need to know about from Now's perspective?
Well, I kind of feel like there's, like, each thing that I brought to the show tonight could probably take up a whole show, but I wanted to sort of give you little tidbits of some of the stuff that...
You're a hardworking woman, my dear. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. So, you know, I wanted to give you some good news and some not-so-good news. I don't want to depress everybody, so I'll start off with the semi-good news. I'm sorry?
No, go ahead.
Oh, okay, sorry. So, you know, we've been keeping an eye on some of the, of course, Alan mentioned that we're working on the election campaigns, and of course that's something that we're keeping a close eye on. So on August 14th, speaking from the Florida Now PAC, the Florida Now PAC has endorsed three of the leading women in Palm Beach County, our constitutional officers, which includes Susan Booker, as supervisor of elections for her reelection. Ann Gannon is the Palm Beach County tax collector and her reelection campaign, and Sharon Bach is the clerk of the courts in her reelection campaign. And we're very excited about those those elections. The August 14th elections are going to be pretty big because they're going to decide a whole lot of the elections that I don't think people are going to be paying as much attention to. So I definitely wanted to highlight the August 14th elections. So that's one thing to start with. In other news, we've had an ongoing Enough Rush campaign against Rush Limbaugh because we know that his rhetoric is again it's anti-women, it's anti it's against the Hispanic community, against the gay community. There's really not anybody I've found that he really likes except for people that are exactly like him. And so we've been campaigning to get him off the air. We've done a couple of rallies. We've done both in Palm Beach County and across the country, we did a day of Enough Rush, and I wanted to make sure that I highlighted that. So anybody who's interested in getting Rush Limbaugh off of Clear Channel radio stations, the telephone number to call is 561-616-6600. If you don't get a person, just leave a message, and that's one of the things that we're going to continue working on because I think that he doesn't belong on the air. We're not trying to limit his freedom of speech. We just don't want them to give him a platform at Clear Channel radio stations.
Meredith, may I ask a question? I'm sorry.
You may. Oh, hi, Louis. I'm sorry. I don't know you either, but it's great to meet you.
A pleasure. I was going to ask you, because this guy, Rush Limbaugh, is on the Armed Forces radio 1 hour every single day spewing all this hatred. Is something being done about that? Because I know that the military said, no, that we're not going to take him out. But,
I think the Armed Forces Radio is part of that campaign. In Florida, we're focusing on Clear Channel radio station here because that's where that's who puts out our signal. But the National Now office, I'm sure, is working on the military radio as well.
Yeah. Because he's spewing all this hatred, and particularly when we have so many women serving in the armed forces at every day risk, not only about enemy combatants, but sometimes, you know, more often their own peers. And you don't need somebody like this freak to go out there and be spewing all this hatred.
Well, I mean, you could say the same thing about anybody in the armed forces who's a black person or who's a person of color.
Yeah, right.
You know, who's a Hispanic person. I mean, there really isn't anybody who is, like I said, there's not anybody who hasn't been a target of his except for people who are exactly like him. I don't know, maybe his wife or something might not be a direct target, but...
But he gets paid with taxpayers' money. That's an incredible thing.
I don't know how he gets his paycheck, but I don't know the hero.
His victims, that's the thing is that his victims pay his check. You see, he gets paid by the Armed Forces Radio from what they collect from the, you know, what comes out from everybody else. But I understand what you're saying. Yes. Thank you.
So in other news, we're also very pleased with the Affordable Care Act passage through the Supreme Court. I know that you had mentioned earlier. You know, I just wanted to point out that women across the spectrum make less money than men, so we're more likely to be on the on those lists of people who may be who may need the support, and this was a huge victory for us on all spectrums. You know, I used to work for Child Welfare Services as well, and the people, the kids who are in Child Welfare Services, this is a huge victory across the spectrum. And I'm really, now is hugely grateful to that decision from the Supreme Court. And I know that they're getting a lot of accolades right now, but I think people are forgetting about the Arizona immigration law that they also... that they upheld, and I think that one, that's something that we're looking at that we were pretty, that I was disappointed in. The Show Me Your Papers legislation, it's the SB 1070, and the fact that they made it okay for Arizona to to target certain communities because they happen to look a certain way, I think was a huge, huge mistake. And we're going to see a lot of people being mistreated and hurt this way. So I just wanted to point that out as well.
Yes, we have made some progress in that arena. Go ahead, Meredith.
I just thought that was a huge. I mean, that was just the Sheriff of Ohio is probably the worst demonstration of, you know, a really bigoted targeting, and I think that the racial injustice was just is it's going to be damaging, and we're going to feel it across the spectrum, like, you know, like waves in a pool. It's going to be pretty bad. This weekend actually has been the National Now conference, and I think that they're taking up some of those issues, including some of the other parts of the war on women, and that issue is definitely coming up as well. And then the last thing I wanted to make sure that I informed your audience on August 24th, 10:00 in the morning, Women's Equality Day celebration is going to be going on at FAU. It's the 92nd year of women getting the right to vote, and we already have some really outstanding dynamic speakers, including our own Supervisor of Elections, Susan Booker, it's going to be a really fabulous morning at the FAU Women's Studies program hosting it, and it's just going to be a really good time. So I just wanted to make sure that everyone knew about that.
Excellent. You'll have to come in the week or two before and remind everybody. I guess you heard that our governor has weighed in, always desperate for some publicity, that he's not going to do anything to support the health care. And, of course, we'll be having to hold his feet to the fire, that's for sure.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, all we can do is continue to make our voices heard with our legislature and make sure that that whatever support he has at the moment is dwindling or gone by the election time. And I really, you know, I'm hoping that the fact that the elections are so imminent that he realizes that he's not going to have as much of that support as he's had, and hopefully it'll deter him from trying to hurt the people in our state.
Well, let me ask you to put your state hat on for a second, and you know, Luis Cuevas of Progressive Push is very active in bringing progressive candidates forward. Are there any women candidates you want to bring our attention to?
Well, I'm really glad that you asked that question, because I just started working with the I just became a member of the National Women's Political Caucus. And, you know, there are, like I said, there's those three candidates that we've already done endorsements on. National Organization for Women, Palm Beach County Chapter, has representation from the PAC that's going to be working on endorsements on the local level as well. So we're still working on the endorsements on some of those races. But I also want to turn people's attention to the National Women's Political Caucus, of which I'm a member. And the purpose for this group is to make sure that women and women-centered and people who support women's issues are also are elected. That's basically that they run. So it's the issue is to seek out people who want to support women's issues, so that they can run for office. So, Rick, if you ever choose to run for office, we would be happy to work with you.
Oh, that's very kind of you, my dear.
But, it's said that men only need three asks for people to ask them three times to run for office, and for women it takes six asks. So consider mine the first, and I'm sure you're going to be asked again. So.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you, my
dear.
We'll be checking.
You know, I always have to do my part to try and make sure that we move on. So, so yes, definitely stay tuned. If anyone has any questions, the PBC Now website is always available. I can be reached personally at president@pbcnow.org. And, you know, my contact information is always on the website, and you know, I can always get more information if anyone has any questions.
You know, I have CNN on in the background, and I saw some actual good news that the women's clinic in Mississippi, there's a stay, and
yeah,
they're not going to close.
That's Good.
Wow.
Good, good. That's great. That's great. You know, I was really surprised that they, you know, actually I'm not really surprised at anything these days, but I was sort of surprised that after they tried to put through the personhood amendment in Mississippi and it miserably failed this last session,
right.
That, I mean, the last election season, that they even tried to do this, especially considering it's the last, I believe it's the last clinic in Mississippi that's still standing. So the fact that they're still targeting this clinic, it's just unfair. And until I got to do this, to start working on this, on the women's issues in Palm Beach County, I didn't realize that we still had protesters here. But, you know, I've been doing escorting at the Presidential Women's Center for the last 9.5 years. And I can tell you, we have protesters in Palm Beach County that are anti-choice. So anybody who's interested in participating in, you know, in supporting women, as they're, all it takes is walking into the center. There's a brief, orientation that comes along with it to learn what to do. You know, it's really hugely important that we can always use volunteers. So, and again, anyone who wants to get in touch with me on that, I'm happy to be the liaison to get them in touch with the clinic as well.
Well, Meredith, you know, you really inspired me there. Let me make a suggestion and offer if I can. You know, you mentioned that women's equality event in August. Maybe we should have a Men Who Support Women event in advance of that to show that, you know, there are men who support women's rights. There are men who support women's equality. And by God, we appreciate the fine quality of women we have in this great country. And you can definitely count on me and supporting you on that, too, okay?
Well, thank you.
Here.
I really appreciate it. And just keep in mind, it's National Organization for Women. I want to point that out to your audience because I know that people can make that mistake of saying of sometimes. And people, you know, we hosted the conference, the Florida Now conference in last month, and it was abundantly clear to the speakers who made that mistake that it's National Organization for Women because we have men that support women as well, and we don't discriminate.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thanks so much,
Rick,
Meredith.
Yeah, Rick, one of the things that amazes me, don't these people have, who are always under attacking women, don't they have mothers, sisters, daughters, wives?
Well, these are the same protesters that cross the line to have an abortion if they end up in a position where they are pregnant and they didn't anticipate it. And, you know, the other thing is we're at the risk of going too far over my time. I'm sure that Rick needs to move on to the next issue. But, you know, I worked for Child Welfare Services for 3 years, and when I was working there, we were just finishing out the 10-year contract that we had with the state to support 1,800 to 1,900 kids in the system. We had just enough money for that. And when I left, there were 3,380 kids in the system. These people who think that they're proponents of supporting women by insisting that adoption is an option, it's not. It's a terrible, I mean, the system is as good, you know, under the circumstances, it's as good as it could be. The people do the best they can, but it's terrible. I wouldn't put anybody that I know in child welfare services, that's for sure.
Well, Meredith, thanks again for joining us. We sure appreciate all that you do, all the wonderful hats that you wear. Keep up the good work here. Long may you wave.
Thank you
so much for having me, Rick. Bye-bye.
Okay, you bet. Bye-bye. Well, we should get our next guest in just a minute. And meanwhile, Luis, let me get some of that great wisdom we always have you on for. Tell us, sir, what are some of the things you're working on right now?
One of the things, I mean, it's incredible that right now we're seeing it from north to south, from east to west, but it's still happening on a daily basis, and that's the violence against women and how our Congress, it can't just move in the direction to protect our women because they are so hell-bent on partisan winning. And they just ignore the fact that, and it's not only women, it's children who are suffering. I mean, it's a treason of the Congress. if we might say, that they have abdicated all their responsibilities, and they're not looking at the fact that there's so very many people in need. Like I said a little while ago, you know, don't these guys have mothers, daughters, they have sisters, they have wives, that they are so willing to condone this day-to-day abuse? It's just amazing. I think it's barbarism. Some people talk about the struggle between civilization and barbarism. I think we are being barbarian in this country when it comes to dealing with human rights.
I couldn't agree with you more, my friend. I'm a firm believer that we have to participate, that the part of citizenship is giving feedback to our legislators, whatever decisions they make. And I was recently moved to call Senator Nelson's office because he had been a supporter of the Gillibrand Amendment to make sure that food stamps could still be sustained. And I learned that he had been a co-sponsor, but when it came up to a vote, he dropped his co-sponsorship and voted against the amendment.
Typical.
Now, his vote wouldn't have made a difference, maybe, but it did. That vote went down. Now, he ultimately voted for the ag bill. Okay, well, 2 points there. But I called his office and asked for a response. I said, what made him change his mind? What turned him away from supporting food stamps? Yes, it would have meant a slight cut to ag business. Yes, it might have meant a slight cut in profits to the ag insurance business. But what was his decision? Why did he change? And they said, well, if you write us an email, we'll get right back to you. Okay, that was 2.5 weeks ago. And every week, twice, I write and say, what was the reasoning behind his decision? I quote the amendment. Curiously enough, our good progressive senator has not yet seen fit to the time to answer this constituent. And I'm a firm believer we have to hold their feet to the fire.
That definitely. It doesn't matter who they are. And the problem is that we keep getting the same story year after year, every election time. And it all comes down to, well, you will vote for me because otherwise you're going to get this other guy. And here's where progressive push has been pushing the issue is that we need to really get some candidates out there. People, begin to take a look at your representatives and your senators. You got to push forward people who will change things. Don't just talk about change. It won't happen with talk and rant. Do something about it.
Yep. Well, sir, listen, I'm going to thank you for joining me so far. I've got a tape to play, an interview I conducted with Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs. You're welcome to stay on and maybe comment at the end. It's about a 15-minute piece, so if you want to stay on, that's great. If not, I just want to thank you from the bottom of my heart, sir. You are always a gem and a jewel and such a great contributor. I can't thank you enough, sir.
It's always a pleasure.
Okay, let me bring on – thank you, sir. Good night. Bring on Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs. Okay, I'd like to welcome Keith McHenry from Food Not Bombs. Welcome, Keith.
Yeah, thanks for having us. That's really fantastic.
Yeah, Keith, this is my my human rights show. To me, food and shelter really start the list. So you've been an activist for a long time on the hunger front. Why don't you go talk about how you got involved in hunger in the beginning?
Yeah, well, I was a college student at Boston University. And to pay my bills, I was worked as a produce worker, and I was just astounded at the amount of great organic food that we were expected to throw away. So I started to take that to these housing projects near where I lived, and as a result, it was I met so many people that were in need of food, and across the street from these projects, there happened to be people that were working on the guidance system for intercontinental nuclear missiles. And you can see that they had all this money, big modern glass buildings, they're well-paid, well-dressed, while they were looking out their windows at people that were struggling just to survive. And that was in 1980 in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And so that's how I got introduced to the idea of starting to feed the hungry. And it was not long after that that I met a group of friends. We went to some protests. I happen to have a professor, Howard Zinn, that would talk about the demonstrations he was doing up and going to in Seabrook, New Hampshire against nuclear power. So I started going to those, and I made a bunch of friends there, one of which got arrested, and we organized a defense committee. And that committee became really the eight people that started Food Not Bombs. And our first real action was to do a bake sale dressed as military personnel trying to raise money to buy a bomber. And it was so effective, we decided just to continue to do that. And now it's led to Food Not Bombs in over 1,000 cities of the world.
Oh, that's such a beautiful story. You know, there's so much activism in the world, so much of it, you know, so well-intentioned. But this is truly, to me anyway, head and shoulders above so many other things. How elemental, you know, if you can't feed the children, if you can't feed the hungry, you know, what the heck is going on? And, I have to salute you at the fundraiser, the bake sale for the bomber. That must have been something to see.
It's amazing. And fortunately, others have picked up on that over the years. I actually saw people in Food Not Bombs doing this in outside a U.S. military base in the Netherlands. So it's not been limited just to that first months of us doing Food Not Bombs, but it's been a feature that other chapters have taken on themselves.
Now, let's jump ahead over these many years that you've been a hunger activist. It seems that for some reason the concept of compassionate conservatism has leaked away. It's trickled down, I guess. And now we hear again and again and again how this city after this city after the next city has made it illegal to feed hungry people. Now, I know a few months back you were actually arrested for a second time in Orlando for the terrible crime of feeding hungry people. Where does that stand now, Keith?
Well, fortunately, after 24 arrests, the mayor gave up and he announced that we could share food at City Hall, which is actually a much superior location. And he essentially is turning his back on his own law that he had worked so hard to get passed, which is a law limiting you to sharing food twice a year per park. And then you had to have a permit, and then you could be even denied that permit. So they seem to have learned their lesson. They dropped all the charges and everything just no contest on a Wednesday, and they dropped all the charges that Friday. But so I ended up having to pay $1,000 fines and stuff from that. But otherwise, that seemed to be a victory. But then in January, we start getting calls from people saying that they were being threatened with arrest in their communities. And this was some Daytona Beach, Florida, and Dallas, Texas, Los Angeles and Santa Monica. And then we found out that they were actually going to pass a law banning us from sharing food outside in Philadelphia and in Houston. So we have started to organize around that. We had our first global day of action on April 1st, and people all over the world actually gave away free food in defiance of these proposed laws or already adopted laws. And so now we're facing this week in Houston the possibility of being arrested for the first time for sharing food there. Their ordinance comes starts on July 1st, and we share food four times a week in Houston, and that grew actually out of Houston Food Not Bombs. We became so active there after Katrina because so many people fled to Houston, and we found ourselves providing the meals at the Astrodome and the Convention Center to the people that who had fled the hurricane. And so since we had so much interest in so many volunteers there, we just kept doing it. The other thing is we're waiting any day now. We share food several times a week also in Houston, in Philadelphia. And that law was to be enforced a month ago. So far, the police have not come out and given us any tickets or anything, but we are still waiting to find out what's going to happen there. And we haven't been threatened in Santa Monica, although they've made an ordinance that we are to apply for a permit each week to share food downtown there. And it also could be an issue where they say that if we don't meet all their rules and so on, they can deny us the permit. And we're seeing that this is a growing trend where city after city in the United States are proposing that they have total bans on outdoor food service, or that they have such extreme limitations that you really can only do it a couple of times in 12 months. And obviously with the economic crisis growing every week, this is really incredible. We need more meals out on the streets, not less. And it's flagged off a lot of nonprofit groups from actually providing meals. We know of quite a number in Phoenix and in Houston and Philadelphia and other cities who've just stopped sharing the food because it was too much of a hassle. So.
Well, I'm sure you heard about the agriculture bill where they found a way to fund an additional food stamps, but Republicans stopped it. They just couldn't stomach the idea that agribusiness might have to make a few less dollars just so that hungry people could get food stamps. I'm sure this kind of thing is just such an affront to people like you who work so hard to get hungry people connected to food. What's going on right now? Where are you now?
Well, I'm in Taos, New Mexico, and we are actually starting a small school to teach people how to grow organic food. And so we've had a number of people arrive from across the country to study with us, called the Food Not Bombs Free School. And it has mostly a focus on growing food, composting and so on, but it will also have, we will share other skills too, like organizing and so on. And the kind of, we here in New Mexico are threatened with all kinds of problems by, large corporations, for instance, an attempt to, force us into to grow genetically modified chilies and things like that. So there's definitely a lot of pushback. And New Mexico is the hungriest state in the United States. There's 17 to 20% of the people of the state don't have enough to eat, and according to the Department of Agriculture, and yet it could be a very plentiful state for agriculture because it's one of the earliest places where people were started farming in the New World, and so it's really tragic that we have so much hunger in a place where you could actually grow food. But part of our problem, too, is not only directly related to laws limiting, abilities for farmers to see. So much money is going to large agribusiness. It's going to large corn operations, soy operations, particularly huge donations of money to Monsanto and these large transnational companies, while, the small little farmers that we see here in New Mexico get no subsidies at all and have to compete with these large companies that are being, bankrolled by the tax dollars. And so at the same time that they're bankrolling these large agribusinesses and not funding operations to do organic gardening and the types of stuff that we're seeing here in the Southwest, they're cutting food stamps to the very people who otherwise, could have possibly benefited if money was diverted towards the type of experiments that are happening in organic gardening that are happening all over the state. And the other thing, of course, is that there's a link between hunger and climate change. So a lot of, we're giving huge subsidies to oil companies, massive support for fracking, which we're fighting against here in the Southwest. And at the same time, we have major fires. So, completely obvious that there's a connection when you live here, and you're seeing just north of us in Colorado Springs, massive fires burning people's houses, Fort Collins north of there. There's fires like to the west of us. We're essentially surrounded by major forest fires, and we usually don't see these kind of things until August, and here it is the end of June, and it's already, we've had the largest fire in New Mexico history. And this we're having trouble. We have to drill wells now to water our crops, because the normal water that we would get from our ditch system, the acequia system, just does not exist. And so we've been bone dry. And this is very unusual. Maybe in August we start to see that the water is not sufficient. But, boy, to see that in mid-June is really shocking.
Yeah, there's so many water problems and water shortages in the West, it's going to definitely exacerbate the fire season, that's for sure. Well, let me ask you one last question, if I may. Is Food Not Bombs planning any actions regarding the having a presence at the conventions this summer?
Yeah, well, Food Not Bombs is organizing a world gathering in Tampa starting on August 20th, and we're really excited about that. The amount of interest in the world gathering is amazing. And as I said before, Food Not Bombs is active in over 1,000 cities of the world. And we have very large presence in Russia, throughout Asia, Latin America, and of course North America. And we have for years helped provide food and organize the Republican and Democrat national conventions. And so we're intending to have our big focus this year in Tampa at the RNC. It's technically legal for us to share food outside in Tampa or in St. Petersburg, although we have been defying those laws, and we don't know if we're going to be subject to them during the conventions. And some of the things that we have done in the past world gatherings, and which we're working on this time as well, are to have workshops on many subjects. And one of the things that the Food Not Bombs activists are really active in at this time are things like organizing puppet shows and how to make your own puppets and write your own scripts, how to, of course, make vegan meals for large groups of people, how to organize like protests and flash mobs and all kinds of different techniques like that. And then also we will be discussing, like, the future of Food Not Bombs, types of things that we can do for instance, when we're facing attacks and we're risking arrest in cities all over the country, you know, we will be discussing, like, a coordinated strategy to defend people's right to share food, and also to strengthen our movement and make it so that we have, you know, a better presence, and that we're sharing food in locations where we really have an impact, where we're reaching the public with adequate information and literature, and that we're helping, you know, play an important role in organizing for our future. And Food Not Bombs, from the very beginning, the very first tables that we did in Cambridge, we had literature trying to show the connection between agriculture and climate change, between human rights and justice and peace, and how these were connected. We had information on against racism and homophobia and sexism. All these issues we've been connecting right from the very first meal that we shared in Cambridge. And today I think people can see that the connections are even more dire, that the energy policies of the United States and the rest of the world and their impact on hunger and starvation is, are directly linked. And this is something that we were, you know, strongly influenced by from people like Francis Moore LePay, Francis Fox Piven, Howard Zinn, Chomsky, and people in when we first were starting Food Not Bombs. And I think that their message in the lessons that they were trying to impart upon people like us when we were young college students is as, you know, valuable today as it was 30 years ago.
Well, Keith, I can't thank you enough, not only for the work. You are a hero of mine and so many other people. How can people who want to support you, how can they get in touch with Food Not Bombs?
Yeah, we have a website, foodnotbombs.net. We have a Donate Today button on there. People can actually financially donate, and we do need funding for both the gathering and for the free school that we're organizing. But the other thing is that we need volunteers, people to actually help us cook and collect food, donations of equipment, like cooking equipment and things like that. And then the other thing is that I'll be, after the gathering in Tampa, I'll be heading out on a book tour. We have a book called Hungry for Peace. People can purchase or read online if they can't afford to buy it. And then I'll be speaking at colleges and cafes, and I would really, you know, you can start to contact us now to book a presentation in your community after the Republican convention.
Well, thank you again, Keith. Keep up the good work, brother.
Thank you so much for having us. That's really cool. Take care.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Man. Bye-bye. Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs. Thank you, Keith. Why don't you go ahead and drop Senator Nelson a note and say, why didn't you support that amendment to make sure that poor and hungry people have food stamps? Thanks a lot. Rick Spezak, News Director of Progressive News Network. Talk to you next week.